Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a space for those who are healing from complex and developmental trauma. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach, survivor, and thriver. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information with insight that can validate, encourage, and support you on your healing journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors and trauma experts, featuring therapists, coaches, and practitioners. We will open up the conversation on effective trauma healing modalities, practices, and tools. If you are interested in trauma recovery coaching, as well as recommended books and healing resources, head over to www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com. And now, here is your host, Monique Coven.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, I'm going to be re-releasing an episode I put out last July that I did with Dr. Janina Fisher. It's based on her latest book called Transforming the Living Legacy of Trauma. And there is so much richness in this conversation because those of us who have complex trauma, we are really feeling like our experience is not something of the past, but it feels very present day. It feels very now, like it's happening now. And so that's what our conversation is really going to be based on. And even if you've heard this before, it's worth listening to again, because the more that we understand our own experience, actually the safer we start to feel, because it makes sense and we feel some validation in it. So I hope you do enjoy this episode with Dr. Janina Fisher. Hi, Janina. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
It is such an honor to have you back, because you've been with us before. And I'm just really grateful. We're all grateful to have you here. So, yeah, so I was thinking that maybe this time we could talk a little bit about your book and your model. So your book is called Transforming the Living Legacy of Trauma. And then we'll talk a bit about the model that you developed. So my first question to you is the name. You know, why did you choose the name Transforming the Living Legacy? And what is the living legacy of trauma?
Right. That term sort of came to me a few years ago, because what I realized is that the trauma survivors don't have a legacy of the past. The past is still alive. That's what post-traumatic stress is. It's the return, essentially the return of the past. And the past keeps returning and returning and returning. We have historically treated trauma by processing past memories, but that hasn't been as effective as we would like for trauma survivors. And then it just hit me one day that the problem is that it's a living legacy and we don't address the living legacy. So we can process a past event, but what do we do about the living legacy of that event that are still being affecting the client's feelings, body, perspective, beliefs, way of relating? So, you know, so the event might be an abusive parent, but the living legacy might be, I'm just thinking of a particular client right now, difficulty sleeping, fear of the nighttime, fear of being alone in the house, a sensitivity to hurt, coupled with rage that gets expressed at her husband and children and actually cause them to hurt her feelings more often. It's a vicious circle. hopelessness, suicidal thoughts, some self-harm. What else? A tendency to go numb. So she's got lots of access to anger, but often no access to any of the more vulnerable feelings. And a phobia of medication. So, you know, we often would recommend medication for someone like this, but she has a phobia of being controlled by drugs. So she won't take medication and she begs for relief, even though she's a very competent and resourceful woman. She has this feeling of helplessness. So that's the living legacy, right? And it's not relevant. I mean, she has a difficult husband, but you know, lots of people have a difficult husband without having all those symptoms. She has a hard job, but many people have a hard job without having all those symptoms. That's the legacy of the trauma. And also she's what I call fragmented. We used to think of that as dissociated, but I see it as fragmentation, as this dissociative compartmentalization, so that depending on what's going on, one or another part of her might be triggered.
Yeah, and that just explains that feeling that we have, that it feels very familiar.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's a question that I often ask. Is this a familiar feeling?
Okay.
Because familiar means memory. And you don't need an event to attach it to. That's the mistake that we made in psychotherapy is, well, if you have this feeling, what explains it? And why should we have to explain or justify a feeling by connecting it to a past event? Why can't we just say that's a feeling that is triggered in certain situations? It's familiar, which means it's memory, as opposed to it's, you know, it's directly related to the situation. But we always look to try to connect feelings to particular events, which I think has been a misdirection in the field.
Okay. So this brings us nicely to your model, TIST, which stands for?
It stands for Trauma-Informed Stabilization Treatment. And it was named that because we were trying to get it approved for use in a hospital for the chronically mentally ill. And the directors of this hospital, the powers in the hospital, did not want a title that had the word dissociation in it, right? So, or fragmented. So we chose, because it's a very stabilizing treatment, we called it trauma-informed stabilization treatment. And suddenly the bureaucrats were saying, oh, okay, that sounds very sound. But it's for people who have read my book, Healing the Fragmented Selves, it's the fragmented selves model.
Right, right. So maybe you could talk to us a little bit about that, because we know that dissociation has, you know, levels. But the way that I have come to understand is that there are parts of us that still live inside of us that can get triggered, that do get triggered. Maybe you could explain a little bit about that. Mm-hmm.
Well, it actually goes back to the idea of the living legacy, because you know, our brains don't just remember events. In fact, the brain's not capable of remembering events until in a, you know, in an accurate way until we're 8 or 9 years old. Prior to that, we have little bits and pieces of stories, or we have pictures. So we remember with our feelings for the first 8, 9 years of our lives. When we get scared, you know, scared is a body response as much as it is an emotional response. And so we have a brain that reacts to the world in particular ways that were designed to help us survive since we were cavemen and women. And under stress, we have the ability to dissociate, not by choice. It's something the brain does. And it takes many forms. But the theory that I use is called the structural dissociation theory, which says that we dissociate or fragment along the lines already built into the brain. Because actually the brain is very fragmented. You know, we say my brain, but we're actually talking about many different structures that communicate with each other, but it's not one whole structure. So the theory says that under traumatic stress, the physical split between the left brain and the right brain becomes also a psychological split. So we can split off our feelings, which is the right brain, and just be logical and goal-oriented, or the left brain goes inactive and we just respond with feelings. And that's actually what children do naturally up until about the age of 11 or 12. Children tend to be right brain dominated. And so even as they're getting older and wiser and more organized, they will have the moments they freak out. And then the left brain is gone and they're in their right brain self freaking out. So the theory says that in trauma, the left brain side of the child keeps on going to school, making the bed, playing with friends, doing homework. And the right brain side of the self becomes focused on what's going to happen next. The right brain also, in a way, holds the living legacy of trauma. The left brain may have no memory of what happened, especially, again, if it was trauma before the age of 8 or 9. But the right brain is not memory-oriented, it's survival-oriented. And then the theory says that the more chronic and harsh the environment, the more splits you need. And so on the right brain side, people start to fragment along the lines of the animal defense survival responses, so that a part develops driven by the cry for help response, a part develops by the fear and freeze response, a part develops driven by the fight response or flight, or by the submission response. And so the theory says that children in a dangerous world, when they're fragmented, have the ability to feel very angry and then switch into being compliant and submissive. They learn that they can't run very far, but they can flee in their minds. They learn to cry for help, not by crying for help directly, but by being sweet and charming and eliciting help. And so that splitting is actually very, very adaptive in a dangerous world. And many of my clients, as a result of that kind of splitting, grew up to be quite healthy, competent adults until all of the right brain living legacy started getting triggered. So this model originally, the structural dissociation model is a model used extensively throughout Europe as a trauma treatment model. I am one of the few people in the US who uses it. And I had the idea, I was asked to consult to hospitals for the chronically mentally ill, which include a lot of traumatized patients. And so I was asked to consult specifically to the subgroup of traumatized patients who often were the most severe cases in a hospital for the chronically mentally ill, which means you're pretty extreme. And I began to apply this model to these very, very severely traumatized, suicidal, self-harming, assaultive, and when they had a chance, addictive or eating disordered patients. And to my delight and probably the amazement of the hospital, these patients started doing better. And because when they began to understand, oh, you're not suicidal, it's the suicidal part of you trying to bail you out. And I remember that the most severe case I've ever consulted to was in that first cohort. And I remember her first victory with TIST. I came for my monthly consultation and she said, "This is amazing. I have to tell you what I did. All day yesterday, I wanted to cut myself so bad. And so I just kept saying, that's my fight part. That's my fight part. I don't have to do what it wants." And she said, "I just kept telling myself, that's not you. That's the fight part. You don't have to do what the fight part wants." And for the first time, she managed to restrain herself or restrain the fight part from self-harming. So that's when I knew it was going to work.
That's amazing. You know, and that's what I, you know, really picked up from your work, is that it's a part of me. It's a part of me. It's not all of me. It's part of me that's feeling this. And just that alone, it relaxes you. It's you feel a bit safe with that.
Right. What it does is it changes your relationship to the feeling or the impulse. So instead of the impulse feeling like my impulse, instead I have a relationship to the impulse. Here's the impulse, and here's me noticing the impulsive parts. And so that brings in mindfulness. And it, you know, we know that's what CBT is. We know that if you change your relationship to what you feel, it has an effect at diminishing the intensity of what you feel. So it's really the same idea as CBT, but it's much more relational. And I think that's part of why it works.
Yeah. And I think when you have them stop, right, and recognize that it's a part of them and they're not enmeshed with that part, it does create, and I probably read this in your work, that pause, which right. allows the mind to come back on instead right. of being hijacked and taken away. Okay.
Right. Exactly.
So how do we begin to to understand this in a practical way. I remember you saying that any huge, overwhelming feeling that we may be experiencing, we can see that as a part. Could you talk to us a bit about that?
Yeah. So to me, feelings that we consider out of proportion, right? So we often say to ourselves, we don't say it to clients, of course, but we often say to ourselves, you know, that feeling he had is an overreaction. And often the client's friends and family are always saying, oh, you overreact. But actually what I try to do is help the client notice an overreaction as a part. So you would have reacted in this way. Your part went apeshit, right? You might have been able to say, we have a problem. Your angry part, just let that person have it. Even if you think about it, suicidality is really an internal struggle, because when we have a suicidal client in a session, that client has a part that's trying to get help and then has a part equally committed to suicide. So by definition, the client has to be in an internal struggle. Otherwise, we wouldn't see the client. The client would be dead, right? So there are lots of internal struggles we hear about in therapy. Should I stay with my spouse or should I leave? Should I stay in this job where I have security, but I don't feel safe, or should I go? And often those struggles are a large part of what brings people to therapy. They might come saying, I hate my job, but then when they say, I've been in it for 10 years, you know, that's an internal struggle. So anytime there's an internal struggle, I say, okay, so there's a part of you that wants to get out of there. And there's another part that can't leave. And let's just be curious about, and I know the client I was thinking of earlier, she'd say, well, I can't leave because I have a meeting on Friday. I have something due on Tuesday. And she would stay for 20 years because she had something due or a meeting or a project.
Okay. So starting to see it as a part of us. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, do we have a conversation with that part as our, I guess, I think you call it going on with life self. Do we converse with that part and try to validate it? How do we communicate with the part?
Well, there's a process that leads up to that. And that's difficult because what I find is that most therapists and most clients are in a hurry. they want to see some results. And so, that just reminded me that a client of mine said, I've seen you now for 15 sessions. I don't feel I've improved. So I'm going to take a month off. And I thought, wow, big ambitions for 15 sessions in which he didn't really want to try anything I suggested. So,
yeah, but you know, Janina, that really is the reality of a lot of us. I remember years ago thinking, yeah, how many sessions until I'm healed?
Right.
Six, 12? So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Two. Right. Hey, I went to therapy. I should be better. Absolutely. Yeah. So We don't want to rush it. That's the thing. Because in the end, it takes longer when we rush it. So the first and most difficult step is helping clients get from I feel to there's a part of me that feels. And so that can take, depending on how willing the client is to accept that idea, that can take a long time. Because as long as the client is identified with the part, it's not going to be possible to talk to that part. You know, it's like having a conversation with ourselves, you know, can be very useful, but it's even more powerful if there is some distance, and I don't mean huge, but some distance, so that there's a relationship, there's a possibility of two sides of a conversation. And so that's, my goal is not to get to the conversation yet. I actually work by way of little goals, because I can't get to here unless we have completed all the steps leading up to it. So first I have to help people notice their most troubling feelings as communications from parts. Then I have to help them with their tendency to identify themselves with the part's feelings. Many, 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 many suicidal people have said to me, for years, I was giving ammunition to the suicidal part because I thought it was me. And when the suicidal part said, I want to die, I would say, I want to die. And so that would be reinforcing. And then often they felt as if they were choosing to make the suicide attempt. They had to answer to the doctors and nurses in the emergency department or in the hospital. And they didn't really get this idea that if they identify with the feeling, it makes it worse. And I really emphasize that a lot, because I think so often, so often we don't realize that if we identify with a feeling, we're going to make it more intense. Which is why we teach clients to say, I feel, because we want to get to that intensity. But that's not what we want to do if people are suicidal. Right.
Or the TIST model.
So in the TIST model, so many, many clients who've consulted me say, as soon as they relate to the suicidality as a part, they stop acting on the impulses. And that's pretty exciting. And that's one of the reasons that I called it trauma-informed stabilization treatment, because we were seeing these very high-risk clients actually stabilizing when they treated the eating disorder as a part, they treated the self-harm as a part, they treated the suicidality as a part. Things started to settle down.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you even talk about certain responses as parts, like freeze as a part, mm-hmm. which is very interesting. Yeah.
Well, all the fear responses from social anxiety, I think of as a part. Panic attacks are really so much better addressed if we assume that it's the panic of a little kid inside us. Again, one of the biggest problems with all the anxiety disorders is that when we identify with the anxiety, Yes, I should panic. No, I can't drive over the bridge. It makes it worse. So the more we separate it, the better off we are.
Oh, absolutely. And you just reminded me when you said about the bridge. I don't anymore, but I used to suffer decades ago with driving far. And it was a child response. I had a fear of getting lost and nobody helping me. But, right. You know, we don't know that. We're just thinking what's right. In front of us, afraid of driving, you know? Right. Yeah. Right.
And then because we have this human brain of ours, we create a story. Oh, I'm afraid of driving because. Right. And you know, I've had some bridge anxiety myself, so I can relate. But if you don't identify with the feeling, then it doesn't rule you in the same way. And you know, what I like about this model, because we could call it fear and help people relate to it more as an object. But what I like about my approach is the relationality, understanding the fear as the fear of that child, right? And so that creates more empathy, as I'm sure you experienced. I think it helps us to relax around it. And so... So I like the relational part. I like building a sense of empathy and compassion for the parts. But first I've got to help people to notice the feelings as parts. Then I have to help them unblend or disidentify from those parts. And then we can begin to have internal conversations.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I remember I was in your class and I remember you showing a video and how often it's just so natural to say I, you know, so that's, yeah, I could see how that would take a lot of time first to really begin to separate.
Right, because it's really like building muscle strength.
Yeah.
And especially for clients who have spent years in therapy learning to say I. Right. So then we change the rules on them.
Yeah. Well, I really love that because also it's a compassionate model too, because it's giving you the opportunity to really both, like you're getting in touch with that child part that was alone, that didn't have help. You're giving a voice to her or him, and you're also building up what I see, the strength of the going on with life self. So it's really a win-win. It's a beautiful model. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. I love it, of course.
Yes. And so is this useful with people, let's say, who have severe dissociation as well? Yeah.
It really works well. I mean, I've had a practice for many years with very, very high functioning clients who are quite severely fragmented. And what I've seen is that it actually, you can use TIST with people who are quite stable, but who are traumatized. Although actually interesting, somebody presented to me recently a case where they used TIST with somebody who had had attachment failure, but not trauma. And it was very helpful to her. So I see this TIST being able to be used with people from complex PTSD to severe DID. And of course, you know, it's going to be harder and slower with somebody who has severe DID. But I think the model works.
Lovely. I was excited, by the way, because I bought the workbook And then I just noticed today, I just a little check, you've got it on audio too.
Yeah.
So I'm really
just came out on audio.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. That's great. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to ask you. Is there anything you want to add to this conversation?
Oh, I just, speaking of the audiobook, I just want to add two things. The Living Legacy of Trauma is a workbook that I really wrote for the therapist as well as the client, because the material in it is a guide for the therapist in helping the client understand trauma and how it's affecting the client. And it also presents a model that's different from the find out what happened and process the event approach, which of course I like. The other thing I wanted to say about that, all the worksheets in the book are available as PDFs. I don't know if you noticed this, on the references page, which was a weird page to put it, but that's where it is. There is an internet link, a web link, that takes people to a site where they can download the PDFs of the book.
Thank you for saying that.
Especially now, when we're trying to work virtually, it's essential to have those pages in a format where you can show the client or you can email the worksheet to the client.
That's really good. And I imagine that's available too with the audio? There might be a link for that as well.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Great. Good. So is there anything else do you want to share before we close on this topic? Or?
Well, the other thing I'm very excited about, which you have shared a little bit in, is that I am now putting together an online training in TIST, which is something that I've been wanting to do for years. Ironically, the pandemic gave me the opportunity to do that, if something good can come out of this crazy situation. And so I'm very, very excited about that. We just finished our first TIST level 1 training. There's a TIST level 2 training coming up. And the training's being filmed and offered by the Academy for Therapy Wisdom at therapywisdom.com. And right now they're running a huge sale for people who want to do the first level at a very deep discount, almost a 50% discount for taking level 1 for people who haven't had it. So they'll be ready for level 2 in the fall.
Well, I took level 1 and I thought it was fab. I loved it. It was fabulous. So grab it at 50% off. That's a super deal.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Right. Don't you wish?
Yes, I wish. Anyways, I love your work. I appreciate all that you do and all that you've contributed and how much you've helped us so much. So thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Monique. Take care. Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Trauma Recovery Coaching offers a safe space to heal. To find out more about my trauma recovery coaching offerings, you can visit my website at www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com.